All right, this is Connor here, one of the producers for Open Source, sitting around the kitchen table with Chris, Mary, and Zach.
Chris, hell of a year.
The year of the great eclipse.
The deplorable year of American politics.
Maybe the awakening of civic life in this country, seriously.
Well, at least it wasn't boring.
Can we say we were never boring? Almost.
But Chris, we always say we dare to be boring.
I just want to interject. We have some Christmas treats. T-shirts. They're here.
T-shirts.
And you can get one, right?
They're beautiful. They're very soft. They got a nice big logo, so you can represent us wherever you go.
Yeah. Would you say it's a cotton blend? What's the? How would you describe that?
It's a nice mix of soft fabrics and...
They are $50 or a $5 monthly pledge on Patreon.
So if you want one of these beautiful shirts, hop on over to radioopensource.org/donate. And there you'll see a picture of what we're talking about, and you can chip in and help us for the new year.
Oh, deep down, serious thanks to people who love this program. We love you, and we're ready for an absolutely historic year in 2017.
Thank you.
Nice.
Put that to music, Beethoven. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the Beethoven Hour at My Piano in Boston. The occasion is Jan Swofford's acclaimed 1,000-page biography, the biggest Beethoven book in a century, about the great man's anguish and triumph. The opportunity is to engage with a discerning player, too. Andrew Rangel made his bones, as the great pianists all seem to do, by performing the full catalog of 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. Years later, Andrew Rangel is still recording the late Beethoven masterpieces. So the piano work is our focus. It turns out even the great piano sonatas like The Moonlight and The Pathetique were conceived as private pieces, quite unlike the showcase symphonies and concertos for soloists with orchestra. Most of the great piano pieces were not played in public in Beethoven's time. We can listen to them now as a journal of Beethoven's inner life, as maps of his improvisational method of composition. In the piano work, we're getting a full course on the musical forms that Beethoven mastered and stretched, the sonata and all its parts, fugues too, and the variations that we're listening to now. Andrew Rangel wanted to begin with these six variations on an original theme, Opus 34, which Beethoven wrote out in 1802. Like other variations, they start off with a fairly simple motif and keep reimagining it, transforming it, over and over, until the composer chooses to let go. Three other personal notes are not incidental to this conversation. Jan Swofford was a composer before he was a biographer. He wrote the big life stories of Johannes Brahms and the American modernist Charles Ives before his Beethoven, and he's still a composer. Andrew Rangel is an uncommonly reflective player, a reader, a writer, a cartoonist as well. Third point, it's only fair to say that these men are friends who have been trying out their different takes on Beethoven over pizza and Patriots games for more than 20 years now.
I offer this as an example of one of the so-called unknown, and not totally unknown, but a lesser known masterpiece that should clue us in about the astounding quality up and down of Beethoven.
Well, it really is as good an example as anything of Beethoven's whole career as a writer of variations, as an imaginative person. I think variations were completely central to him. This is also written in the summer. It was paired with the Eroica variations, which were really the beginning of the Eroica symphony. And this was the same summer that he had his big crash and wrote the Heiligenstadt Testament saying, well, you know, I'm going deaf and I'm sick and I maybe should kill myself. And that was a perfectly reasonable thing to say. And he said, but I won't. Or am I wrong? This was 1802, wasn't it?
I'm not going to dispute.
I think he learned to compose by writing variations because it's the idea of taking one thing and making it into other things. The tone of a lot of Beethoven variations, including the gigantic Diabelli, is basically comic. And what he does, if I'm right, Andy, is he makes a kind of big, splashy ending, and then he has another ending after it that's ironic. And he's really saying, ba-dum, well, isn't this nice? And I'll make a very gentle ending now. And the ending of the Diabellis are like that. They're in the middle of a bar, and he's sort of saying, you know, another thing about variations is they're theoretically endless. You know, sonata form has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a coda maybe, and everybody knows. Variations can go on forever, theoretically. And I think part of the joke of the Diabellis at the end, he's basically saying, you know, I could do this forever, but I have to stop somewhere, so, you know, cheerio.
You say variations, and I think immediately of Brahms's Variations on a Theme by Haydn. Everybody knows that tune. I also think of jazz. It's a fundamental form. I think of Paul Gonzalez's 26 choruses with Duke Ellington on Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue. It's take it again. Take it in a different direction.
And I think it's, for Beethoven, an essence of what composition is all about, which is you take an idea and then you make it into different things. But it's all the same thing. And that to him, to Beethoven, no matter what he was writing, was what composition was about. It's taking something and making that thing into other things that sound different. And I think that's one of the reasons variation was so important to him. I think it was really ingrained in his whole approach to composition in some ways, that idea.
Big picture question. When did Beethoven become Beethoven, all caps, and how?
Well, let's put it this way. He started at about age 10 being told that he was the next Mozart, and he never doubted that. He never had any questions about his gift. And a lot of people think they're the next Mozart. He happened to be right. Maybe the only person in history who was more or less right about that. I've never saw any indication that he ever had any nerves. He wasn't scared of anything or anybody, but he was very aware of what was out there. And he built his career early on, first as a pianist. He was, when he got to Vienna at age 22, he was already one of the best pianists in the world. And he had a style of improvisation that just blew people away. There'd never been anything like it before. And then he very carefully, step by step, you know, managing his opus numbers, began to create a body of work very consciously and very aware of, okay, when I write string quartets, I'm getting around to your question. When I write string quartets, I'm up against Haydn. Therefore, I'm going to be careful. When I write violin sonatas, I'm up against Mozart. I'm going to be careful. When I'm writing cello sonatas, I'm not up against anybody. And when I'm writing for the piano, I own this. I own the piano in a way that he didn't believe Haydn and Mozart could. He said those guys are harpsichord players and harpsichord composers when he was drinking beer and sounding off. So he shaped himself in a very clever way. And when you have the kind of just sheer pianistic brilliance that he did, he was cock of the walk in Vienna in his 20s. And his stuff, yeah, there were people who didn't like his stuff, and it was very original. But he wrote, you know, he wrote crowd pleasers too. The Opus 20 septet is, as Beethoven said once to his publisher, get it out, the rabble are waiting for it. And it's a delightful piece. So he was very astute about all that. He was as good in music as he was bad in everything else. And simply at a certain point, he had attained a stature that was harder for Mozart and Haydn to attain, partly because of actually publication. He was the first composer who was published extensively from the beginning. And eventually everything he wrote was immediately published. And that had a lot to do with spreading his name and his fame and so forth. So it was not a moment when he became Beethoven. When he wrote the Pathetique, Opus 13, which we say, oh my God, that is sheer Beethoven. That was just one of several voices he was exploring at that time. And then at a certain point around 1801, he said, you know, I'm not satisfied with anything I've done. I'm going to take a new path now. And then he began to create the things just one after another that we call Beethoven.
Andrew Rangel, you're our piano guy. Take us inside, wherever you want.
With regard to the piano, it can be, of course, said that in no other genre, in no other place, did Beethoven so significantly register himself as a composer and as a man in the most consistent and comprehensive way. His piano sonatas begin with Opus 2. He's about 25 or something. And the sonatas were pretty consistently produced as the most intimate and private of his works and his special laboratory, you might say, almost until the end. The Pathetique is, of course, the best known early thing.
Opus 13.
And at that point, the fourth or fifth work in Beethoven's so-called C minor scowling mode, and it is by far the most rhetorical and most melodramatic.
But it is an example of what he brought, I think, the Pathetique, this kind of naked emotionalism and passion that had really never existed before, even though he's still using Mozart and Haydn's forms to a large extent. You know, it's still in the old bottles, but it's a very new wine.
People are used to hearing about Beethoven's three periods, three scenes, three acts. How useful is that to talk about where he goes in his mature middle period and then the late style?
The first period, people try to say, when did it begin, when did it end? It's much more fluid than that. He was bolder earlier in his piano music, in his cello sonatas, in his piano trios, exactly because he knew what Haydn and Mozart had done, and that he was not going to be up against their best, where he knew in string quartets and symphonies and opera, where he knew he was going to be up against the best of Haydn and Mozart, he was much more canny in how he got into it. And that's why the second period was really something that kind of gradually took over with this image of, we call it the heroic period, even though not every middle period piece is heroic in style. But then there's that middle period, and then there's the sublime late period at when he was mostly deaf, yes. That is more of a break, I think, between first and second.
We're hearing the slow second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata number 8, the Pathetique, Opus 13. Coming up, the work and the life of Beethoven's middle, so-called heroic new path. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source, the Beethoven Piano Hour. We're sitting in my apartment with two good friends, masters in their fields, Jan Swofford, author of the new Big Brick of a Beethoven Biography, and Andrew Rangel, whose hands are all over the piano. He's playing Sonata number 7 in D major.
you know, we think about the heaven-storming Beethoven, and here we are playing his slow movements, which are some of his greatest achievements. He wasn't always shaking his fist at the heavens by any means.
This is interior. A very early one.
Yes.
This is a very prophetic one.
Jan, some basics about the man. The boy from Bonn, born 1770, into a peculiar family. Not incidentally, an age of revolutions in America, in Europe, in many places. Marked, as you say, at 5 or 6 as a prodigy. Take us from that outline of the biography to the music.
Well, when I started working in the biography, I wanted to know how he arrived at being the kind of composer he was, and that has to do with his growing up in Bonn. And one of the first things I realized was that he was not a revolutionary composer. He never claimed to be. At age 14, you see him basing these piano quartets on some violin sonatas of Mozart, very closely based, but you see in every case, Mozart has a slow introduction, Beethoven's is longer. At the beginning of the Allegro, Mozart has a bar of dissonance. Beethoven has 4 bars of dissonance, and his dissonance is stronger. His key is unusual, E-flat minor, the whole piece is... In other words, he took the past and did it more intensively, and he stretched and bent, but he was always true to the past. But he came of age intellectually and artistically in the 1780s, which was the revolutionary decade. And I was reading the Bonn newspaper in those days. It was the idea that humanity was turning a corner into a new place. Humanity was going to get its act together. There'd be a science of government and a science of humanity. Well, these were dreams that did not entirely turn out, but they were tremendously exciting. And these were things that people sat around cafes and talked about, and the philosophy of Kant.
I was going to say, Immanuel Kant sort of presides on that era. Schiller is the poet. I mean, we know Schiller mainly because of Beethoven, but he was a very big deal in the spirit underneath.
Of the 1780s in particular. Well, I'm not going to try to summarize Kant. It sounds like a Monty Python routine, but...
go ahead.
What Kant said,
what's the bumper sticker on that guy?
There's a world out there. There may be a God, but we can't know it. We cannot know the ultimate nature of reality because we're stuck in ourselves. We're individual human beings on this little speck of cosmic dust. And that seems pretty simple, but it changed humanity's sense of itself radically. And therefore, he said, you cannot trust scripture. What Beethoven believed, and what a lot of romantics believed in that respect, was that nature is scripture. Nature is the true scripture. And that's Beethoven stayed true to that for the rest of his life. But meanwhile, the idea of Schiller, Schiller's Ode to Joy was one of the most, what's the word? It defined the revolutionary 1780s. It originally had verses like beggars will become princes and so forth and so on. It was a revolutionary poem that young revolutionaries sang in the street. It was written as what's called a geselliges song, a song to be sung in company with glasses raised. And Beethoven intended to set the Ode to Joy as a teenager already. He didn't get around to it till the Ninth Symphony when it was
already... Did it have music before he wrote it?
It was said over and over again by various composers, maybe 40 times, something like that. Mm. But that poem, among other things, represented that era, and that era was where Beethoven lived. He was not a romantic. He wasn't really a revolutionary, but he believed in that kind of rationality and that kind of humanism that came up in the 1780s. He was sort of a deist. He wasn't that interested in Christ. He was very interested in God. And as I say, he wanted to deal with God man to man.
God to God, maybe.
Maybe. And nature was his religion. And that's why I think the Pastoral Symphony is ultimately a sacred work. He was not involved in scripture. Later on, like a good deist, he got very interested in Indian religion and Hinduism and so forth.
Sounds Jeffersonian in a way.
Oh, absolutely. That is a good... And he was not a churchgoer.
It's also an interesting point of difference with the Jesus-centeredness or uncenteredness is a big departure from Bach. Bach wrote on those manuscripts, Jesu Juve, Jesus help me.
And Beethoven, when somebody gave him an arrangement of Fidelio in which he'd written at the end, finished with the help of God, Beethoven wrote under it, man, help yourself. And in the Heiligenstadt Testament, his great despair, he didn't say, I must do what God put me here to do, because he didn't believe that. He believed that God in the form of nature gave him his gift, but what he did with it, he did himself. God didn't do it.
We're talking about Beethoven at the piano. I want to hear more about these pieces in all their variety Give us the sound, Andrew, of these sonatas as sort of journal entries in sound from his inner life.
Oh, there is so much variety. There is incredible assertion and violence and declaration. At the same time, there is something tentative, something poignant, something indeterminate. Every piece presents a new facet. Hilarious jokes, gruff jokes, the whole gamut. And I have to say that in reading Jan's biography, I am shocked again and again how during a period of great inner turmoil and stress, and a great deal of Beethoven's life had inordinate stress and indisposition, to say the least.
Physically and mentally.
His response at all times is such an amazing variety of musical gestures. For instance, the sonata that starts with this lovely lyrical.
We should say, this is Beethoven's Sonata number 18, Opus 31, number 3, The Hunt.
This absolutely charming, teasing kind of...
Seductive
kind of thing.
I didn't know it a week ago. Now it might be my favorite Beethoven. And I keep thinking, what a contemporary piece. If Richard Rodgers had that idea, he would have made a song. If Gershwin had thought of it, Ira would have written an incredible show tune, love
right.
lyric.
Right.
There's something utterly timeless about that song.
Right. Well, you know, it's such a gorgeous opening, in fact, that Schumann used it in his A major. It's a delicious, entreating harmony in what's called a 2-6-5 chord. You don't know where it's going, of course, and then he changes the register.
And he goes and he takes it in a direction you don't expect, which is kind of goofy in a very engaging way. And then he has a second theme, which is almost a satire of a classical theme. Can you play a little of the second theme, Andy?
Yes, the second theme is
marvelous. It's a cliche that is being made fun of as he introduces it.
What happens actually very early on is this. You get... beautiful variant of the first harmony. This is actually the second theme. It's in the appropriate key. And I want to point out that built into the second theme is already a reference to the first theme. This is a completely Beethovenian kind of strategy. There are all kinds of cross-references and a kind of constant development.
And variation.
And variation, right. I'll play the theme here. That... 1, 2, 3. It's the same as... But the ear is tricked. The ear doesn't hear that three-quarter note, dom, bom, bom, bom. It was
One thing becomes many things.
One thing becomes many things. And this sonata, by the way, is one of the most radiant. It's a four-movement sonata with no full slow movement, only a gorgeous minuet. And it has two movements that are very boisterous and very propulsive. And it's absolutely one of the most up pieces.
And that brings in the fact that Beethoven thought of pieces as a whole. He thought of them as a narrative arc from beginning to end with sometimes sadness. And that beautiful D minor that is one of the saddest pieces ever written is in a four-movement sonata in which the first and last movements are wildly comic. Mm. So there he's experimenting with putting together comedy and tragedy in a way that, you know, is unique to the two pieces in that... three pieces in that opus.
I have always thought that starting with The Moonlight, which has the most arresting and the most memorable and, you know, the most iconic.
There's somebody in every kid's high school class who could do The Moonlight.
And this, it was legendary from the day it was published for that reason, that almost anybody can play it.
Well, but almost the real truth is almost nobody can play it. Well, it is an incredible movement, this open, in fact, the whole piece is an astounding piece.
It is so unique. There'd never been anything like it. I don't think anybody forgets the first time you hear it, because it is just a wholly formed world that you'd never imagined before.
I want to hear it under your fingers, Andrew. Well, can
just a little
I can
of it.
Play just, the thing about this piece is that the form of it reverts to three movements. It backs away from, he had written a number of four movement pieces. It begins with a solemn, slow movement that is the epitome of stillness and is one of the most profound, meditative, and kind of minimal pieces. The elements are hypnotic because they have been reduced to a kind of almost oppositionless flow. That is a melody that moves so slowly that what really registers is a central triplet figure, a slow-moving bass figure, and such a slow-moving melody figure over the triplets that it almost doesn't register. You know, when people are asked, what is the melody of the Moonlight Sonata? They go, do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, this hypnotic triplet. In the middle of this movement, there is something that is so immobilized. It is a pedal tone, which is a low bass note that does not move anywhere, over which everything drifts. And this is an astonishing event which leads to a kind of a recapitulation. I'd like to show what this pedal tone is. It starts this way. Capitulation here. And again, the same pedal tone. When you look at it closely, this kind of musical control, the intended emotion is something very veiled and very mysterious and very sorrowful, but the actual technical means by which this is achieved is pretty stunning and also unprecedented.
As a composer, every single note has to be right in something this simple. there can't be a false note anywhere, and that he and there isn't. But I want to give people a sense of the whole arc of that piece, like the beginning of the second movement, the beginning of the third movement, which is so astounding.
Well, the piece ends with these. Actually, the piece is written. It's one of the first Beethoven sonatas explicitly in which the movements are connected without pause.
Which is part of the fantasia aspect.
But it is the subsequent two movements that also define the piece, one of them an innocent minuet, and then a furious, the heaviest movement in which the first two movements really are preparing.
Give us a little bit of each of them.
Yes.
And then
it's very innocent. And then,
and then this face.
This ends with this cadence. And then you hear.
Absolute fury. So he's, again, he's putting together antitheses in this particular piece. It's not what he always does, but that's what this piece is about.
And again, this piece is a shocker. It's like nothing before
it. But it's still the same thing. These opening, what we call arpeggios, do-do-do-do-do-do, and the last would become do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's the same idea, completely changed.
Now, John, mark the start of the late period, and maybe begin with the famous Heiligenstadt Testament. He's 32 years old, torn between complete despair and his great
despair,
love of his work.
And defiance is the word I'm looking for. Right. Despair and defiance, and you see them both. But that defiance was with him all along, and it was simply a matter of, he said in the Heiligenstadt Testament, I can't imagine leaving this world without doing what I know I can do. And he was just beginning to figure out how to do it.
Listening to Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 28 in A Major, Opus 101. Coming up, the late style of a piano master after his famous Heiligenstadt Testament, a letter from 1802 in which Beethoven, becoming deaf, contemplated suicide. It was only my art that held me back, he wrote. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden, and this is Open Source, entering the world of Ludwig von Beethoven during the composer's late years. The music here is Beethoven's very last of 32 piano sonatas, Opus 111, written in 1822, at which point Beethoven had descended into total deafness and every kind of bad health.
By the way, this is a theme that it commences and ends with the same interval. I mean, it ends this way. Goes on. This is a kind of purged theme. This follows a movement of utter fury.
Yeah.
And by the way, this piece is the consummation of a whole series of sonatas in two movements. Now, this is a radical return. He starts some sonatas back in the middle of the middle period, Opus 54, Opus 78, Opus 90, and finds different kinds of complementary movements. This is, again, somewhat shocking when you think about Beethoven's big, bustling sonatas in four movements, in three movements. In the gigantic sonatas of the middle period, the Appassionata and Waldstein, you have two huge movements connected by a very interesting tissue, a kind of a shortened slow movement, which is in effect an introduction to the last movement. So those pieces, in a way, are they're two movements plus. But then he goes to these very small and just astonishing two movement pieces, and the consummation of them is the final sonata, where you have a very concise and propulsive movement, followed by a gigantic, long unfolding kind of beatific.
That goes into these trills, and a single trill, and then a double trill, and it's a triple trill. It's like a celestial light that just overcomes.
It is otherworldly, is really the word to describe this piece.
A friend of all of ours, John McDonald, the composer, who listens to Beethoven, remarked on your observation of the variegated surface and texture of all this stuff. Incredible internal variety within a piece, variety from piece to piece. And yet, listening to all of it, there's a consistent experience of Beethoven, the mind, the energy, the mystery. So his question really is, how did he find so many different ways of posing questions and answering them? Was it just hard work? Was it a technique? Was it temperament?
His journey was more than anybody. I don't think of it, any other composer went as far as he did, from the Opus 1, two piano sonata, you know, the first piano sonata to 32. It's a gigantic journey. And you can say the same thing about the string quartets and the symphonies. That's another thing that's special to Beethoven. Yes, Bach made a big journey, but I don't think anybody made a journey like Beethoven. I don't think you can account for that. It's an intellectual and spiritual thing of remaking himself that he had, and it was always precipitated by disaster, I think. The disaster of crashing and realizing, I really am going to go deaf, and I've got chronic digestive miseries that aren't going to go away, and that became, led into the second period, and then finally going deaf, losing his last love, and that, in effect, his response to that eventually was the third period. So in a way, his life propelled him to a degree into these things. But that doesn't account for the imagination involved, which is just unsearchable. Well, I want you to understand something. When he was writing some of the very late music, he was dying heavily of cirrhosis of the liver. His body was filling with water, so he had to wear a girdle to keep his stomach together. He was physically miserable. In the middle of all that, his nephew tried to kill himself, which the nephew survived, but Beethoven was devastated. And yet he was writing. So when I got there in the book, I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what he was going through and how far his art was beyond that.
We haven't yet mentioned the bagatelles.
Yeah, the bagatelles emerge first in Beethoven's middle period, where he writes a series of, I think, seven bagatelles, Opus 33. They're not among his greater masterpieces. They're kind of big-boned and at times slightly clunky. He wrote a series of late bagatelles, sort of little scraps from the Diabelli, which created in these little shards and fragments an amazing floating miniature world, some of which are completely improvisatory, others which follow neat little ABA formulations. This is Opus 119. Then he seems to have reached a kind of synthesis and the most profound sort of integration of big and small with the six bagatelles, Opus 126, his very last significant piano work. This is an exceptional piece, the Opus 126, and perhaps we can hear it on recording. ¶¶
The bagatelles in general are really the beginning of the history of the romantic miniature character piece, which all flowed out of this, things like the Chopin preludes, part of which are, the point of which is to be as if fragments. You know, a big gesture that would be the beginning of a big piece, but then it's over. And the bagatelles do things like that. Beethoven is so aware of the setting and the traditions of everything he wrote. These are pieces that weren't to be played in public. They were to be played for yourself and for your friends. Pieces of piano solos were not played in public in those days. Chamber music was not played in public in those days very much. That was about to change, but... and Beethoven, you know, Beethoven's symphonies are different than his chamber music because the tradition of the symphony was that it is a public piece. It should be simpler in a way. You know, the Times said that string quartets are for connoisseurs. They're for people to play who really know their stuff, and it's as much for the players as it is for the listeners. Whereas symphonies are for the public, and therefore they should be more direct and more immediate, maybe simpler in form. And on the whole, Beethoven conformed to that, but he's still within the understanding that he had of the social traditions of music. He still managed to be as, you know, radical as ever.
Andrew, can we come to Opus 131, which is a world, a cosmos unto itself, written for string quartet. You transcribed the first movement for piano. I want to know how you came to do it and why. Lead us in.
Well, I have to say that very early on, I was drawn to certain works by late Beethoven. I started listening to the string quartets, and there is so much stirring and just astonishing music in them. Within the last quartets of Beethoven, the most intimate lead-in and the most unusual voice, this fugal, this deep, deeply lamenting opening. This naked seeming fugue with these strange and archaic harmonies drew me in, and it was much later, I forget exactly when, but somewhere in my middle age, in my early middle age, that I wanted very much to play it myself, partly because I felt it could stand a kind of conversational quality between the voices and also more rhythmic flexibility than I was used to hearing it as played by string quartets. So that is what impelled me to actually start, so to speak, interpreting this piece and eventually to recording it several times, in fact.
Well, the first thing I always say is that Richard Wagner called the first movement the saddest music ever written. It's a good example of Beethoven taking the idea of fugue, which was regarded as something learned and intellectual and old-fashioned, and making it radically new and old-fashioned at the same time, because he's really returning to the Renaissance, this very severe counterpoint. It is also totally... the whole movement is not a fugue. In a different way, every time he comes back to the idea of fugue and putting it in the context of modern sonata form, he does it in a different way. And he does it in a different way. He begins with a fugue, and then he develops it as if it were a sonata theme. For Beethoven, the sound of the instruments themselves are expressive and moving. The form itself is moving, you know. He's thinking expression and technique all at the same time, and they work together.
And one additional dimension of the sound, and this is very striking in this opening movement, is that when you consider the disposition of the voices, you know, Bach wrote his incredible fugues to lie under the compass of 10 fingers at a keyboard. But Beethoven, at this late juncture, writing a fugue in this opening movement, manages to use these tones and to distribute them in different registers. And Beethoven does this kind of distribution in the most masterful way. Of course, starting much, much earlier.
And the most expressive way.
And the most
expressive. And that's the movingness of this music. Yeah. Is what we're saying is has to do with the very sound of it, as well as the notes. We tend to say it's the notes or the harmonies that make things moving. Well, it's also the way they sound. These experiments with texture of the string quartet, after he's deaf, this is one of the things
that
boggles me. He remade the sound of the string quartet after he was deaf. The Ninth Symphony sound of that is totally new, and that was also after he was deaf. I mean, how do you do that? I wish I knew how you can do that.
Right.
Surely the Opus 131 has that kind of intergalactic feeling of not only life after death, but all of the earth, all of life viewed from some completely different dimension.
I want to add another element talking about the ethereal. He read in a newspaper a statement of Kant, which actually is on Kant's grave. It said, "I'm always amazed by the starry sky above mirrored by the moral law beneath." And I think, and Beethoven copied that out on a piece of paper and put it under glass on his desk. It was with him as he wrote the late music. And I think that image of the starry sky, which is God to the Enlightenment, God is there behind the stars, as it says in the Ninth Symphony. And the moral law on earth that we discover as human beings as a reflection of divinity, I think is a lot of what he's getting at, and he's literally evoking a sound at times in the Ninth Symphony, the Missa Solemnis. It's his God sound, his beyond the stars sound. In the Missa Solemnis, there are all these lines going up and going down. And I think it's the human striving up and the divine reciprocating, the divine coming down, and there's this circuit that goes from earth to the heavens, and that is part of his thinking in the late music, always, I think. I think it's always there.
Jan Swofford and Andy Rengel, thank you so much. Jan, your book, Andrew, your recordings, your hands on my piano are a huge help to us civilians. You've really taken us someplace in this conversation. Thank you. First note to last, it's been a thrill.
For us too.
For us too.
We come back to Earth more enchanted, deeper in debt to the heavenly Beethoven. We're going out on another late bagatelle in G, Opus 126, number 1, published in 1825. You can find this piece and all the other music from this program on our website, radioopensource.org. Jan Swofford's big new book is Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph. Andrew Rengel's many recordings on the Steinway and Dorian labels are available online. We drew especially on his latest CD of Beethoven's final masterworks for piano. Connor Gillies produced and edited this hour with help from Max Larkin. George Hicks recorded and mixed it. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.